This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, last month, on April the 5th, I had released a podcast with Chip Romero in which we had talked about Doug Henning. Well, I didn't realize, I guess, how popular that Doug was going to be or that particular episode was, and there seems to be a lot of interest in Doug Henning. And I don't think it's been something here of late. It's been something kind of underground, I guess, that's been boiling for a while. In fact, there has been a blog or a website that has been going for a year as of the 1st of May called The Doug Henning Project by Neil McNally. And Neil has been posting things each day of the work week. He takes off on the weekends, but he's been posting pretty much daily updates on things having to do with Doug Henning, kind of like what John Cox does with his website in wildabouthoudini.com. So this Doug Henning project also will post pictures and updates and different stories that might be either in the news or things he's heard about or conversations he's had with some people or emails he receives, etc. But nevertheless, it's very interesting, as if you're interested in Doug Henning, then you need to go and check this out, because on a regular basis, he does post some very interesting snippets and facts about him. You know, I started to say factoids. I don't know if you know this, but the word factoid, it doesn't mean just a little fact. Actually, a factoid is not something that is necessarily true. It's something that could be, I guess you can call it, fake news in a way. And so when the media uses the word factoid, I don't think they're using it properly, because it does not mean it is actual in fact. That's just an aside. Anyhow, the point is of what I'm talking about is I think that if you're interested in Doug Henning, this might be another one of those blogs that you want to bookmark so you can go back and read every day during the weekday. It's not very long, just short snippets, kind of like with John Cox's blog then as well. But he has some interesting things to talk about here this week. And Neil tells us what all has been going on, as well as a new documentary that he's going to be working on. And most documentaries, for the most part, don't really make money. They're just pretty much a work of passion. And this whole project, the Doug Henning Project, is certainly a passion for Neil, and he's always looking for new material. And towards the end of the podcast and our chat, that he tells us how that you can contact him if you have any stories or pictures, or you would like perhaps talk with him on the documentary. He would love to hear from you and get some pictures and speak with you about your firsthand experiences with Doug Henning. During this chat, there was a time I talk about whenever I had met Doug Henning, and he was performing at the Kiel Opera House in St. Louis, and I referred to another magician who was working with him. I referred to this other fellow, I believe, as Tony Van Domlin. Boy, was I way wrong. That's not at all who I meant. But the person I was meaning to refer to is Johnny Lawn. So as you're listening to this, it makes more sense if you hear me talk about Tony Van Domlin, but really insert the name Johnny Lawn. That's who I meant, who was a past winner of FISM. In fact, he had received a third prize in manipulation back in 1967, and he toured then with Doug Henning, I believe, for a season. Also, if you can stick around to the end of the podcast, I have some other news just on a personal note that I would like to share with you. But for right now, please welcome our guest this week, Mr. Neil McNally, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome our guest today, who is a noted historian, particularly on Doug Henning, and he is the one who runs the Doug Henning Project, which is a website that has everything to do with about Doug Henning. If you want to know something, this is kind of the place to go. So please welcome my guest, Neil. Hey, Neil, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going today?
Good, thank you. So, Neil, you're in Los Angeles, did you ever see Doug perform? I know he was out there from time to time.
No, I mean, unfortunately, I'm not of the age where he was performing at the time. I was like 10 or 12 when he was done. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, you would have been kind of young, I guess. Your parents would have had to have taken you, I guess, to the show or something. You know, I was talking with Chip Romero about that, and he said he was 17 whenever his uncle, I think, had taken him to, they were in Las Vegas and saw him at the Hilton Hotel perform there. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And whenever I saw him, it was in 1980 at Kiel Opera Hall.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Yes, you posted those pictures up. I remember that. I saw it online. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So you had never seen before him, but you obviously were impressed by him, I guess, by watching him on television.
Yes. What happened was I've always been a big fan of magic history. That's always, I mean, my original interest began with like magic posters. And then as a kid, I just read more and more about past magicians. And what happened was two things really were the impetus. I'm also a big fan of the Muppet Show, and Doug was a guest on that.
Right.
So at a young age, that really was profound for me because he really identified well with the characters and you believed him when he was on it. So that was like my first exposure with him there. And then when I was in high school, there was a used bookstore that was right by my school. So I bought the Houdini book that he wrote with Charles Reynolds. And that was such a profound book for me that it always stayed with me. So so through the years, I lived in Chicago, I moved to New York, and then I moved to Los Angeles. And the Magic Castle is in LA, and I'm a big fan of going there. So I was really thinking about Doug after I read his biography. This came out, well, Spellbound came out in 2009, but I read it about a year and a half ago, and it really made me rethink Doug. And I've always been a big fan, but I really felt that he didn't have the recognition that he really deserved because he really brought magic back.
Right.
And so I looked online. There were no websites. There was absolutely no websites. There wasn't anything. There were a couple fan pages that were from like 2000 and 2001, but they were very old.
Right.
So I was just amazed by that. So I thought something had to change, and I wanted to be the one. So.
And so that's how you developed then the Doug Henning Project.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And also, I was going to say, I noticed that you use WordPress, I guess, did you build that from WordPress?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
It's a very good site. I like it. It's very interactive and easy to get around and everything. You know, we were talking about the Houdini earlier. Mm-hmm. We were talking about Houdini, and John Cox has his Wild About Harry website. And, of course, now he posts something every day, and I always find that amazing that there is so much material about Houdini that you can actually find interesting stuff every day. And I would think that similarly that there would be something about Doug Henning. Do you post things just irregularly, or does it come up every week, or how often do you post?
I generally post something every day. So people send me things. Well, actually, it's with John Cox, when I started to think about doing this website, I did consult with him on like how he went about with his. So he gave me some good advice. But I generally post every day. When I first began, I interviewed Jim Steinmeier, John Gaughan, Milt Larson, and John Cox. And that was the first month. So, but after that, I had to get more stuff on. So people send me their collections. They send me pictures. I befriended his family. Well, his sister, she participates. She's also sent me some things as well.
You say Henning? You mean Henning's sister? Yeah. Doug Henning? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So she's been really nice. And generally, as it's gone on, people, there's a lot online. There's a lot of collectors send me things. I've even helped collectors sell things. So the more you post, the more interest there is, and it generates content.
Yeah, I would think certainly that it does. One thing kind of begets another. I mean, it's just, again, like this podcast, that whenever I'm posting things, that people will send me ideas saying, hey, you know, that since you people, your listeners like this, they might like to go a little bit deeper and learn more about this or that. And so in particular, like with this, when you do post things, are they firsthand experiences from people that they have shared with you, I guess, or what kinds of things? I mean, just to kind of give a taste, I guess, for someone who hasn't gone to your website, I mean, what can they kind of expect?
Okay. Well, when they come in, I mean, I'm close to 200 posts now. So they're not always, sometimes I'll do like a theme week. There'll be one week that's a theme, or like I'll do like an interview with a person that did know Doug. And because they're usually so long, I will break it up over like 5 days. So we've done that. Also, sometimes it's just, there is no connection from day to a day. It'll just be, sometimes people will send me pictures or when they met Doug, and then I ask them to actually explain it, and they'll write out something about their personal interactions, or I'll feature a costume, or I'll feature a fun fact or pictures. It's been really good. Some people have sent me pictures that have never been published, so I actually really appreciate that. That's one of my favorite things, is when you see pictures that aren't anywhere. So I've been really happy with that. So it's generally just a general celebration of Doug and his, what he did. So
right now, as far as some of the things again that people are contributing, and you do break that up, do you send them an email saying, you know, like, here are 20 questions and can you respond, and then they kind of come back to you, or do you have specific things as to ask specific people about certain things?
Well, certain people I've done by phone. With his sister, I did speak to her by phone. Sometimes it depends on my own schedule, and I can't always be on the phone, so I'll give them a choice. Do you want to do it by phone, or do you want me to send questions? So generally, sometimes they do prefer the questions, and it's been really good because some of the people he's worked with, they can think about the answers, and they can really like reflect on that time, and it really makes it really like well done. So.
Yeah, I was looking back for an example that you had something with David Ogden Steers, who was in the Magic Show with him. Now, how did you go about contacting him?
Well, I didn't. No. I did a tribute for him. I didn't actually contact him. That's when he passed away, though. But for other people like Jim Steinmeier, I just found his website and reached out. And he agreed, and we met at a cafe, and he spoke to me for hours about Doug. I generally just reach out. I figure out most people have websites, or there's a general contact online.
That's true.
So Brian Lumley, who worked with Doug early on, him I had no contact with. He worked on Spellbound. He was there for the Magic Show. He was like, before Jim Steinmeier, he worked with Brian Lumley. So I didn't know where to get in touch with him. So on my website, I just put, I'm trying to find Brian Lumley. So then all these people started to give me information. And by the end of the day, he contacted me.
Wow.
And that's been really fun. It's like, you want to get in touch with somebody, and then they're just, and then somehow someone will help you. And, but generally people are just very enthusiastic about speaking about Doug, what he meant to them, just working with them. I think a lot of people have this pent up, and there was nowhere to go with these memories and thoughts. And it's been a good avenue for them, and it's been wonderful for me.
Right. Now, you mentioned earlier about Charlie Reynolds. Of course, he was instrumental in working a lot and very closely with him. And again, you were young and did not ever see Doug perform, but did you ever get a chance to meet Charlie or talk with him?
I did not. I mean, I've spoken with a lot of people that did know him.
Yeah.
So, I would like to speak to his wife for the website. So, eventually, but I mean, his influence on Doug was really profound and important, and,
right.
His place, I mean, is big in Magic history, obviously, but with Doug, it was crucial that they came together at that time.
Right. And when I mentioned David Ogden Steers earlier, that I thought that you had actually spoken with him or had some conversation, maybe by email or something. So it wasn't until after he had passed that you had posted something.
Yeah, I did like a short tribute actually, and that post was really really successful. What I did with that was I just did like a tribute, what he did for the Magic Show, and a YouTube clip of him in the Magic Show. So.
Right. Well, he was pretty important, certainly, for those people who, when we're mentioning his name, who may not know who he was, although he had a small part in the Magic Show, he was better well-known, of course, than as Winchester in the television show MASH. It was a long-running hit TV show here in the U.S. for people who overseas who are listening and wondering, why are we talking about this guy so much? Now, so you've had over 200 different postings up there, so this means that it's been running for basically less than a year, I guess, if you've been doing it daily.
May 1st will be the 1 year mark, actually. So, mm-hmm. I remember I didn't know how it would be received, and I just began the first week, and it took a bit. People found it at first, but over time it's gotten very popular. It's a joy for me to like put posts up each day. There's always that point where you think, well, what if I can't find something for the next day? But something always comes in, and there's always something online or a bit of merchandise or just something that you can always find. I mean, I really like doing the research and finding something that people haven't seen or don't know, and that's been the most fun.
Yeah, I think that it certainly would be. And again, like with John Cox, you know, posting something every day with Houdini, I would, again, think there would be a lot of things that would be of interest in Doug Henning's life, because you're not talking about just the man who was on Broadway or just the man who was on television, but also, you know, transcendental meditation and working with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, you know, and being in India and all the different things, you know, and of course, being in school in Canada and having the grant to study magic and worked with Slidini and Vernon and others. I mean, that I just think that there are so many different facets of his life that you,
levels.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the general public conception of him is with the rainbow spandex and just like being stuck in a certain amount of like that time.
The hippie generation. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a wonderful part of him, but he's just so many levels. Like you mentioned, the transcendental meditation, the theme park, the magic show. Merlin, to me, is one of the most fascinating parts because there's so much going on at that time, and it wasn't the magic show. It was a much more expensive Broadway show, and it's it's like I feel like I know Doug, but I don't know him. But just going through his like history, it's just so many levels, and I don't think people know that. So that's one of the reasons why I began the website. So.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned about Merlin. I am assuming that he had that show. He wouldn't have had that first because of how much money was spent to produce that show, because his original show and the magic show was, you know, kind of, I'm sure, very cheap by comparison.
Yes.
And then
yes,
it wasn't until he became more well-known after his television shows and everything. So he finally, you know, had more backers saying, hey, yeah, we'll put you. But the funny thing is that, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Merlin run for less time than the magic show?
Yes, it did. Yeah, the magic show ran for 4 years, actually. And Merlin, I don't have the dates within me right now. Its preview period was very long. It was about four. If I'm wrong, someone please correct me. But it was like four to 5 months of previews, which is normal now, mm-hmm. but at the time people were like, why is this happening? The show is going to bomb. But I think it only ran for a little under 11 months, I think. I could be wrong. I may be wrong, but it definitely didn't run as long as the magic show. So.
Yeah, that seems to ring a bell with me. And I do recall them having some problems with something, and that's why they kept tweaking it for this long preview. And as you say, now that's kind of the norm. But back then, it's kind of like, well, you should just have a few days or maybe a week, but not as long as they've had, you know, the months, you know, run like that.
I mean, the general conception with Merlin is that it didn't do well. And ultimately, it's actually more fondly remembered now than it was at the time. It's it's kind of like a lost musical because there is no cast album. There are some clips online, but not a lot. Mm. And because Jim Steinmeier said to me that when he works now, people are like, oh, you worked on Merlin? Oh, wow, that's wonderful. And I think the people that saw it, it had a bigger impact on them than people think. So,
yeah, because Rita Moreno, I think, was in that. Is that right?
No, it was Chita Rivera, actually.
Chita Rivera.
That's
right. Yep.
Yeah.
Sorry. But I'm surprised that there was not a cast album. I'm sure that there is a some music. I mean, what am I trying to say?
Well, there are people that were in there. And I mean, I do have the soundtrack. It doesn't sound that great, but somebody sent me the soundtrack. I think at the time people did private. Like that were there, they recorded things. So
yeah,
I think
bootlegged it, I guess.
Bootlegged, yeah.
So. You know, now that you mention that, somebody many years ago had sent me a bootleg of that, or no, it was the Magic Show. Seems like there was. Didn't the Magic Show actually show on a Canadian TV show one time?
Yes, it did. They did way after it was done on Broadway. They made a staged version that was filmed, and it wasn't released at the time. And I believe it was released after he died. So, but it's like it's the Magic Show, but it's like a larger version of the Magic Show with like things that weren't in the production originally. They redid some of the songs as well, so things were taken out. So it's a version of the Magic Show, but it's not the original, like, on stage production.
Oh, okay, because it has that feel, obviously, because as you say, the camera was actually just showing the stage. So I thought it actually was one of the stage productions.
No, I mean, it's if you want to watch it, that's kind of that is the only way that you can watch it, though. So.
And where is that available, or is it commercially available?
Yeah, you can find it online. Amazon has copies, though. So.
Okay.
It's $18. It's like super cheap. So.
Okay. I was mentioning earlier about Merlin and having the music to that. I had an opportunity once to buy the music from the Magic Show, and I was in a bidding war with somebody else. Another guy got it, and that was fine. But I assume that is still available.
It's not now. I just bought a CD. It was a used one. It was like $25, but I've seen brand new unopened CDs that are like $100. I mean, it used to be in print, but as far as I know right now, it's not. So
yeah, it was not the CD, but this was the print. It was the music. I mean, that, you know, just go on your piano or something. What am I trying to say?
Songbooks?
The songbook. Yeah, basically. Yeah. So you're saying that they stopped printing the songbooks, so that probably is a valuable thing now.
Yeah, I don't think there's much out there for it. I mean, you can find the soundtrack, but it's sort of just it's expensive now.
Yeah, interesting. I guess I should have bid more way back then because it was something of interest to me. I do have a button from Merlin. You probably have seen those also. I think I bought that on eBay many years ago as well. What I'd really like to hear are some of the stories also, some of the new people that you've talked with. I mean, obviously there are some things that immediately come to mind that it was an interesting story that people may not know about, Doug.
Well, I think a lot of the most fascinating ones for me are the people that met him backstage, because he would come out backstage.
Right.
They're always aspiring magicians backstage. And he would take the time to talk with every single person there, as far as I can tell.
Yep.
And he would pose for pictures. And these people still have these pictures, and they've sent them on to me. And some I put on the website. And I don't know if Doug knew that he was having as profound as effect with these people.
Right.
But he did. And I think it was his kindness and the way he talked to each person, took the time, answered their questions. It was like a one-on-one encounter that for him, I think, was just part of what you did. And I think he did care. But for these people, they still have these pictures. And I've seen a lot of them. And you met him, too.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. And I think those are some of the most fascinating ones. I've also had a few weeks ago, a magician sent me an account of when he was in a magic club in Canada. And Doug was not famous at that time, but he would come in. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of thought as like the next big thing, but not quite at that peak yet. And so he spoke to this magician who was 12 at the time, and he gave him advice, spent time with him, just really had really cared about what he wanted to do as a magician as he got older. And this is like 1973, and here we are, and he's still talking about it, and just really impressed that Doug took the time to speak with this 12-year-old. And
right.
It just is with people. And I'm from everything I've read and speaking to his family. And I mean, that's just what he was. I mean, there were no pretenses. What I like to project is that Doug was just a very kind man mm-hmm. who cared about magic. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to do with the website is to project that because Doug can't speak now. So it's up to people like us to speak for him.
Tell his story.
Yeah. Cause if we don't, it's just going to be lost. And I mean, he's always famous. But I think there was a point that he was famous before the internet, and he retired before the internet, and he died in 2000. So I don't think he got focused on transcendental meditation and auctioned off his belongings. So I don't think he was thinking about the future of his career and the legacy maintenance and all of that. So that's just kind of what I'm trying to rectify. So
yeah.
And that's just what I just try and show that, people were affected by him.
Yeah, you're right that I had met him backstage, and it was interesting. I told the story several times about how that he was nice and cordial, and we shook hands and started talking a little bit about magic, and there were two ladies who were backstage wanting to talk about TM, and all of a sudden he just kind of turned on his heel, and, you know, that was the center of focus. And so, which was fine. You know, as it turned out, there was another magician working with him in that show, Tawny Van Donlen, I think it was, and Tawny has since passed, but he was a comedy magician. From the Netherlands, I believe, and he was on a TV show called Mumbo Jumbo, It's Magic, or Hocus Pocus, or something, you know, the Tom Bosley, you know, an HBO special or something. Very funny guy, as I recall that he kind of had blonde hair, not as long as Doug's, but back then it was still a long hair and a big, thick mustache and glasses, and he was blonde. But his thing was that things went wrong, kind of like with Cardini, I guess, you know, that he would make something appear, and he had this this radio, you know, that he was vanishing at the end, and then, you know, it kind of fell apart and it broke, and he was dragging it off by the by this electric cord. But the point was, and the story was that, you know, he was somebody else. In other words, that the whole show just wasn't Doug. He had another show. I mean, just like on his television show that he had Shimada, or he would have Ricky Jay, you know, perform on his television show. But when I was backstage, and I was that's the first time I'd met and only time I'd met Tawny, that he had. I said, man, that was a great show. It was a lot of fun. And he said, I'm sorry, what? And I said, it was a great show. It was a lot of fun. He said, I'm sorry, I still didn't hear you. And it wasn't until that third time, I was like, oh, okay, got it. He just wanted me to hear you say it again. So more people who were around could hear me say it a little bit louder. That was a great show. You know, people turn around and look. And say, but he was a funny guy. But yes, he was from the little... The short interaction I'd had with Doug, that my story is too, that of everything that you had just said, that he was just a nice, a congenial fella, and would you know, open the door. I mean, to any and everybody. Just said, regardless of age, I guess, as far as spending time with them and encouraging them to pursue whatever their dream was, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the fascinating things about the magic show is that he would have aspiring magicians just like waiting at the stage door, and I've spoken with magicians like John Stetson, and he told me how, like, as a teenager, he would wait for Doug, and Doug had him, like, he had to go to a TV show, so he would go with Doug to the TV show and just help him bring his things there. And years afterwards, he ran into him at like, an airport, and this is after Doug was done, was building his theme park, and he went up to him and talked to him, and Doug remembered him. He couldn't – it took him a – took him a second, but remembered him as one of the people that would be there during the magic show. And I mean, from all accounts, Doug would take magicians like teenagers backstage, do tricks, run them through the paces. He really took that mentor role like to heart, and I think that's a good thing. I don't think many people would do that now.
Now, and, you know, as far as some of the television shows, and you've talked with some of the producers, I guess, of those shows, have you?
I've worked with people. Well, I've talked with John Gaughan, who worked on them, and Jim Steinmeier, but not the producers. But they've told me. I mean, John Gaughan told me a lot about what happened with those shows.
Yeah, like for an example, one of them. Now, Johnny was not involved with the first one with the water torture escape. Although I understand that there was an issue that Doug almost died in that.
Yeah, there's a lot of conflicting stories about that. I don't think Doug really was prepared for what that trick, what actually came with that, because he just said, and this is all well known, but he just said, I'm going to do this. He pitched it to NBC, and they were like, fantastic, that's wonderful. So then they actually had to figure it out.
Yeah.
So Brian Lumley came in and his people, and they had to fix it. And yeah, there were some times where he couldn't breathe properly, and his breathing exercises from transcendental meditation helped him just sort of like block out the fact that he was upside down in a water torture cell. Cause the average person, their first reaction is to sort of like freak out at that point. So,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, it went well. I know he performed it, after the special for his stage show, but I think after a point, it just became harder to pull it off. So I think he stopped after a point. So it became dangerous to perform it like live all the time. So,
yeah, I don't recall that he did that in that show in the 1980s, or the show I saw at Kiel Opera House. He may have, but But he did take that on the road and toured with that.
Yeah, I know he did it. His Pantages show in Los Angeles, he did perform it, from what I've been told. So
yeah. The only thing I really remember, I guess, from the stage show was the Torn Restored newspaper.
Oh yeah, of course.
Which I guess was a signature piece of his that he always did.
I don't think he stopped with that. That became his like big thing. So
yeah. Now, have you had a chance then to talk with Gene Anderson for your page, for your project?
Yes, we've exchanged some messages, and he's answered some questions, and I'll put those up soon. So I mean, he's been super nice, and he's just talked to me about he sent me pages from his autobiography as well. So I mean, he definitely knows Doug. I mean, definitely was with Doug at the start. So he's a super nice guy.
Yeah, I would think that he would have a lot of invaluable material to give you, because as I understand it, that Doug and Debbie had lived with him for a short time even.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, yeah. They definitely, yes, he definitely did, so.
Yeah. Now, did you hear any stories or anything about how he had first met the Maharishi and why he decided to get into TM?
Yes, well, TM basically, he got into that while I believe they were doing Spellbound. He didn't really get into it until he met the Maharishi at a conference. His first wife was also into it. So I think he met him at an airport, actually. That's it. Yeah, they met at an airport.
Yeah.
So Doug met up with him in his car, and they had a brief conversation, actually. So yeah, that's how that happened. And he was just very taken by him, obviously. And I think that was probably the shift from really being into it, but then it became his like whole like life at that point, though. So I think from there, I don't know the logistics of like how that happened and why he was into it so much, but it became a fabric of what he was, though. So,
well, one of the things that has always confounded me, and it still does, is that he was going to be developing this theme park, as you alluded to earlier, the Transcendental Meditation theme park called Vedaland, V-E-D-A.
Yes, Vedaland.
And I was wondering what kind of rides, I mean, what type of park, I don't know how you could compete, since he was going to be building this in Orlando. How would you compete with Disney World? Did it plan to have rides, or were you going to be having these sessions you would go and sit and try to levitate?
No,
what was the deal?
I think that might have been part of it. I mean, from what I've talked with, like, John Gahn helped out, also Jim Steinmeier. It was a very cerebral theme park. From what I've been able to read and talk with people, there would be this ride, this really kind of crazy ride, where you would go through like the human consciousness and become like a teardrop and go into the stem of like a flower.
Wow.
And become, yeah, I mean, it's very like, I don't know how they would have done it.
Yeah.
But, and there would have been like a castle that like floated above. I mean, it would have just been like hovering there. And I think this is all great stuff in concept, but I don't know how you would actually like build this stuff, though. So, I mean, if it did get built, it would have been an amazing place, but I don't know how.
Well, everything that you're talking about there sounds like it would have been so far ahead of its time.
Would have been, yeah.
There would be something that they might envision now, certainly, as you could do with virtual reality or something, of course.
Yeah.
But from way back then, because that would have been like when, 1985?
Yeah, five. I mean, he was still trying to get funding right up until he died. The Maharishi sent him to Los Angeles in 1999 for funding, and that's kind of how he came back. So the Maharishi said to him, look, you don't do magic now. However, for fundraising for the theme park, but also for the organization, could you do some small tricks? So he did. And then he came back to Los Angeles. He went to magic shops, and I think he found magic again from that. It's weird because he gave magic up, and then he wanted to build his theme park, but then the theme park brought him all the way back. So it kind of came to like a full circle thing. And when talking to people that reconnected with him at that time, there is always that like, what if he came back to magic? Would he have come back? We don't know. But he, at the end, he did find magic again and found that happiness, just doing simple tricks, just being back, speaking with people. I mean, I think it was a really fun time for him.
That's interesting, the fact that he had, I remember him giving that up and then going in over to India and all that and working on Vedaland.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of a, a small fade out. I mean, the fact that he came back in and that he was trying to raise money and doing magic was the way to raise that money, I guess, and then finding that spark again. So it was, you know, he never had the notoriety at the end of his life that he did when he was at his peak.
I remember when he died, I was 22, I think, or something. And I remember I read it and I was like, and he hadn't been around for a bit. It kind of just became this thing of like, what happened to him? And when you talk with people that knew him, I mean, he was out there, but he just stepped back. And then, but I remember when he died and I read it and I remember just thinking like, wow, that's really sad. Cause you didn't really, people like that, you don't think of as like, I mean this in the best possible way. You don't think of them as people. You think of them as, like inspirational, like figures that don't exist quite in the same way that we do.
Yeah. Mythological figures almost. Yeah. I mean, Mm-hmm.
So I remember when he died, I remember thinking like, wow, that was that. I wonder what he was up to. And then doing the website and talking to people and his family. Now I know what he was up to at that time. And I mean, he might've come back. I don't know. I mean, it's nice to think. I don't know what Doug would have been, would be like now, what his act would have been like, but it would have been wonderful. I'm sure.
And what year did he die?
He died in 2000.
In 2000. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be interesting to know what his act would have been like had he come back and how that TM may have changed him with all those different ideas and things, you know, that he had. Certainly. I don't know how that whole thing, I agree with you, could have been put together back then because they didn't, you said it was kind of certainly pre-internet days and pre-computer technology and a lot of things that he was envisioning. I mean, it sounds like what you're talking about, almost like the little thing in, It's a Small World.
Ride, you know, kind of
a thing that you'd be on a ride and kind of go through all this area, you know, and so I can see something like that, I guess.
I think in talking with people that worked on the project, I generally flat out ask them, like, do you think this would have happened? And they generally think, no, it wouldn't have happened. I think the fundraising was really hard. It was really like a hard thing for him.
I wonder how invested that the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi really was in trying to get that happen. In other words, if he was sending Doug back to Los Angeles to try to raise money, you said for Vedalayan and also for his project, I would think that he would rather have money more for his, for the Maharishi's own personal, well, not his pockets, but basically for his movement, I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know the details of the of that organization, but in my research, all I can glean is that there was just constant fundraising for this thing, and they would get locations. There was one; it was going to be in Niagara Falls at first, and then that got canceled. And then it was going to be next to Disney World in Orlando, and that may or may not have happened, but I think that got canceled too. So I don't if you go to their website now, they claim the theme park will one day be actually out there, but and they mention it as like, this is Doug's last project, it's going to happen, and there's like a computer mock-up of what it could have looked like. But I think it's one of those things that will always be in people's heads, and I don't know if we should actually, it's just one of those like things that could have been. So
right now, again, as far as the Doug Henning project and your website and that you've built over here and continuing to work with that you have so many stories and things. Now you and I beforehand had talked a little bit about this other project that you've got in mind that's going to be a documentary. So tell me something about kind of what do you have in mind with this.
Super psyched for this. With the success of the website, I was like, well, what else do I do? Because I always think about, like, what else can I do? And there was no documentary. There was absolutely no documentary about Doug. He's been in documentaries about the art form, but not about him.
Right.
So I just think in the age of documentaries now, they're very popular with HBO, Netflix, Hulu. It was time. So I have a producer, and we have been talking to people. We've been conducting interviews. I don't want to say all of the people that we've spoken to, but they're all definitely people that knew Doug and worked with Doug. Some very well-known magicians are speaking with us. And, our goal is a feature-length documentary. And the family is okay with it. I mean, I've spoken to his sister, so they're on board. And I just really want to tell a very truthful documentary about him. Also, the website has done a lot. but I think a documentary will really cement in people's heads who Doug was, what he did. And I just think the world right now is kind of not the happiest place. And I feel like as a people, it's good to be reminded of what came before. And Doug's positivity and wonder, and they use that word about him, wonder, would really be a fantastic thing right now. So we're planning it, and we're going to Las Vegas, not this month, but next month. And it's going to happen. It's definitely. And then what we're going to do is we're going to have a fundraising thing on Kickstarter. So that'll be out probably in about three months or so. So I'm very into it. So
good. Now, how much are you looking to try to raise on Kickstarter?
Well, a lot of magic documentaries do fairly well on Kickstarter. I know. If we could make $100,000, that would be wonderful. So I mean, but I mean, I can't predict it, but I do know that the level of interest that is in this will probably help us. So.
No, I would agree wholeheartedly. And yeah, that's the way to go, certainly with doing some crowdfunding like that, because
yeah.
I had spoken before with a gentleman who is working on a documentary then also about who Erdenace was.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to find, searching for Erdenace, I think, basically. And they had reached their funding, I believe, on that. And I've spoken with some other documentarians who have finished some movies, and everyone is telling me it really is a labor of love, much like the website is, or this podcast is, from the standpoint that it's certainly not financially successful, that you're going to be able to feed a family or anything like that. But it's something that is just takes a lot of time, not only just to interview and the hundreds of hours of film, and that you may not even know where that's going to go. And that's, I think, an amazing thing about what happens with documentaries is that you have an idea, and then it's going to take you perhaps a few years, to record. And as it evolves, it becomes a more living thing for you, because for the most part, a lot of times, I think the documentarians like yourself are doing this like on a part-time basis. And so as you're kind of starting to shoot something, then you might find that actually it's going in a completely different direction. And then it's like, hey, you found out something. I mean, that was the there have been several examples of that, but without getting into any details, the idea is that sometimes that it might be a dark side that you kind of find about a person that you're trying to look into that, you didn't know to begin with. And that was not what you were searching for. But then you find people who open it up and it's like, okay, well, this is a completely different direction. You end up, at the end having a completely different type of documentary than what you had started. And those are often the ones I think then become pretty successful, if not financially, at least there are a lot of people, maybe Netflix will buy it out or something, I say, for example, there was one about James Randi. I think that.
That was wonderful.
Yeah, it was a great, it was a wonderful documentary. And, the way that came together, I think that there were some surprising things in that one. And again, other documentaries. I guess I'm kind of saying all that to just say, I know that you're looking to try to raise some money then soon with Kickstarter, but it's going to take some time before this whole thing. They might have Vetted Land built before that you get you get your documentary filmed and finished.
I mean, our goal is to have it done within 2 years, so hopefully we can pull that off. People are interested. People are very positive. A lot of people we've spoken to have just been really embracing it, because I mean, I think a lot of people feel that they owe Doug something, or if they didn't work with him, they feel like they're in this business because of him.
Oh yeah.
So and it's really, it's just been a really positive thing. And we began planning it, I think, last August, actually. So it's definitely, the pre-production has taken a very long time, and just coordinating with people. I think the website has helped, because a lot of people have been to the website. So they know that I'm into it. I'm very positive, and they know that that will be an extension of that. So because of the website, people have been open. But the problem is scheduling people can take a very long time. So you just have to call them, stay on them, and write them. And eventually it all comes together. But we've been doing per month, 2 to 3 interviews per month. Mm-hmm. So it's been well. Fortunately, a lot of the magic community is in Los Angeles. So that helps. So we haven't had to really leave LA, but next month we're going to Las Vegas, though, so that'll be fun. So.
Well, I know that there is a lot of money that would have to be spent for the rights to show some of the clips, like from NBC or whomever else.
Well, right now we're not focusing on that fully because I want to get the doc, because I want to talk with people first. That's more in post production. So there have been conversations about that with the people that do own the rights. So we have to keep. We haven't been solved that yet, but it's definitely there are tons of clips out there. The specials are the most important thing, I think. So especially the first one. So I mean, eventually we'll figure that out, though. So
yeah, I wouldn't be discouraged, because you could get discouraged if you just kind of dwell on that to begin with. Say, oh my gosh, just, you know, that's not going to happen. But I think if you kind of get into this and then they see the seriousness of what you have done and what you've accomplished, they may say, well, it will cut you a deal, or, you know, that this is a real thing now. So anyhow, I think.
Well, I don't want to divulge too much, but we were told, like, for us to, they will, who, the person that owns the rights will speak with us down the line, but not right now. So, I mean, sure. So it's just, we need to, so my view on this is, like, well, let's just dive in and make a great documentary. So.
Right. No, I would agree, with that. And that's the route that you have to go. certainly. I remember there was another documentary many years ago that was in production, that was for the life of Andre Cole. And they talked with me about this one time, and this had to be 10 years ago. And I don't know what happened. I mean, sometimes that things kind of, you know, life intervenes or other things happen, things don't come together the way that you kind of hope they do, you know. So I'm hoping this is something that does develop and does happen. Certainly, you know, it sounds to me, if nothing else, maybe a nice PBS special or something, you know.
I mean, I just think we live in a very fortunate time when documentaries are very big now, and there's a documentary about everybody, really. I mean, there's just every month on HBO, Netflix, Hulu, there's always, and PBS as well, there's just always documentaries. And I think magic always holds a fascination for people in a way. And the Amazing Randy documentary did well, and that ended up on Netflix and PBS. So I just think Doug is just one of those unexplored things that needs to just be explored more. And I'm very passionate. That's why they're called passion projects. So Doug is a very positive thing for me, and I'm really passionate about just showing people Doug. And I think it'll be a fantastic piece.
No, I think it will be as well. That's just, again, something that it sounds like that you have the passion for that, certainly. And it's going to show in does show right now the results on the website that you got over there, and that it will be in the project that you're going to be completing in the documentary. Now, as far as continuing into the future, you know, when I talk with John Cox about his fabulous site, he doesn't see any end in sight in the future. And the same thing, I'm guessing, with you, that this
is
just, no.
I mean, it's become, it's just
a living, breathing thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I have my job, but part of my day is like with the website. So you just make it like, I mean, you have like a mental schedule of what you can put into it. And I mean, I used to think when I began the website, well, I'll do it a few times per week, but I do it 5 days now. So
yeah. And so you do take off on the weekends.
I do, yes. And I've been taking a few weeks off recently because I had to travel, and my job was, I couldn't manage it. So I'll be back on April 9th, actually. So
now, do you do magic yourself, actually, or you say you've been inspired by him, or do you?
I've taken lessons at the Magic Castle, so I've done that, and that's fun. I mean, I'm more of a fan of magic history, but I love it, though. I mean, it's fun. I mean, I wouldn't call myself a professional, but I like it. So
right.
Obviously. So.
And what type of magic then do you do? I mean, or that you like? Do you happen to like stage or close up?
Close up is my big thing, and I also think that was one of Doug's. I mean, for me, he really excelled at that, so I really appreciate that form. It's just a very intimate way of being with the audience. So.
You know, there's a conversation I think would be interesting for you to have, is one with John Cornelius, who had invented the Fickle Nickel that he opened that special.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, that is such a wonderful opening for that first special. I mean, when I first saw that, I mean, the way, I mean, he could have opened that first special in any way. Like, it could have been like lions or a spectacle, but it's just Doug on a stage by himself with that. And it's like on live TV. That's crazy. So
Right. And but I think that it'd be a short enough piece that, I mean, there's not a lot of story to that necessarily when you do talk with John, saying, you know, how did he contact you or did you submit this to him? I mean, John has always been a very creative guy and an open guy, too. I say open. He's kind of a secretive guy in a way. I mean, but he won't, you know, once you get him talking, he's a really nice fellow. He lives in San Antonio.
Okay. Oh, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. You should chat with him.
Most people don't say no. I've had a couple. It's very rare for someone not to want to be spoken to. So
why would they say no? Why would somebody say no?
I think the memories of Doug for some people are what they want to keep. I don't know why. Some people just don't. I don't know. I don't get. I mean, and I respect that. I totally respect their wishes, though. It's not a lot. It's not a lot. And most people are like, I would love to. That's wonderful. And they're like, I love the website. I like. Yeah. I just think it's been a way for people to that have been holding on to these thoughts for a long time. It's a way just to like speak and get Doug out there. But yeah, some people I think they just don't want to, and it's fine. So
yeah. Well, it's the same thing with the podcast. I mean, I've only had a couple of people. I mean, literally two people who have said no.
Yeah, that's for me too. So
so for the most part, that I think everyone is fine with talking. And again, particularly with you, that you're going to be sharing something about history, and you want to, you know, leave an indelible mark. I mean, that is already there, but a lot of these stories can be lost unless that you have them recounted. That are firsthand stories. I mean, people, there are not a lot of people who have seen Houdini now and can give firsthand stories. There are a few, but they're getting fewer.
Yeah, there's not a lot.
Yeah.
I think this is good for the documentary and the website, is that we're at a point where a lot of the people that work with Doug are here. I mean, some have passed on, but we're just at a good point. And I feel like if I were to wait like 5 more years or 10 years, there wouldn't be as many people. And I mean, so I think it's a perfect time and for the website and for the documentary at this point. So.
Yeah, that's another thing, too, is I would think that when I was talking with Chip Romero about collecting some of Doug's things, that it would be easier and cheaper now than it will be later when it becomes more collectible, I guess. If it's just like after someone has passed, that the longer time that passes, the more that their stuff goes up, basically, in price. I remember some years ago sitting around a table at an IBM convention that we had a collectors meeting, and there was, you know, John Gaughan and Mike Caveney and all these other guys who were talking about their collections and things they have. And, you know, what is it that you collect? As we went around the table, and I was collecting posters from our contemporaries because it didn't cost very much at the time, you know, whether it was David Copperfield or whomever. They're like $10 posters, which eventually will be going up. My thinking is that it may not go up much in my lifetime, which is fine, but perhaps that my kids or grandkids, if they don't throw away all this stuff, which they probably will, that maybe that they will, hopefully not, that they will eventually find some value in that, not just from the financial value, but also like to put some pictures up, you know, that I have framed already that I think is just beautiful art, you know?
Yeah, no, it's fantastic art, actually. Yeah. So
do you collect stuff personally as well?
I do. I mean, I collect a lot of Houdini stuff. I mean, I don't have the funds for, like, the big items, though. But if I have, like, you know, pictures or magazines or posters, I try and, I mean, and also with the Doug stuff, I buy things as well. So, I mean, I'm just a really big fan of magic art. So if I see something, I definitely pick
what would
it
you
up.
Say is the most important piece that you have to you? It may not be the most expensive piece, but something that means something to you of Doug Hennings.
I have the original Spellbound program, actually, so which is framed. It's the card, actually. It's like the poster, and then if you flip it over, there's like a registration card where you can purchase tickets, actually. So that was Spellbound. That was the very first thing. So that, I think, is my favorite.
You say it was Spellbound or Merlin? I thought you...
Spellbound.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Spellbound is what he originally did. He reconnected with Ivan Reitman, who he went to school with, and Ivan Reitman went on to direct Ghostbusters, all these influential films. So they did Spellbound, and not many people remember Spellbound as a show, but they know it just as how important it was. And then the producers of The Magic Show happened to be there because they had heard some things, because Ivan Reitman took this full-page ad out and the producers came, and from that the magic show sprung from Spellbound. But I love the art. It's just Doug looking really happy. I can send you a picture, but he has this top hat. He's young, and the design is just like Spellbound. And then so many big people worked on that show, like David Cronenberg, who went on to be a director, and Howard Shore, who composed many films. So I think Doug really attracted big talent at a point when they weren't so big. But you can make a lot of connections from Doug to people like Paul Schaefer, like all these people. Like Paul Schaefer worked on the Magic Show. I mean, he was in the band. Martin Short went to school with Doug. Ivan Reitman, who not many people know, they were close friends, and he directed Merlin as well, and he produced the Magic Show. So a lot of people, I mean, a lot of what Doug gave to people is out there still.
Yeah, and Spellbound started in Canada, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people know this. Like Ivan Reitman and Doug were trying to do a show, and Doug wanted to do like a magic rock show, and that was his concept. So him and Ivan Reitman would come up with ideas and try and find funding, which I sympathize with now for my documentary.
Right.
But so they finally found funding. But what happened was at the space where it was going to be performed, they had a show drop. So the owner of where it was performed called Ivan Reitman saying, we need a show like right now and for Christmas. So they pulled it all together and they did the show for like a month, and it did really well. From all accounts, it wasn't really a great show, but everyone just was so entranced by Doug and his stage presence. And there were technical problems. His associate Brian Lumley said there were a lot of problems, but everyone was just always drawn to Doug, his like presence and just who he was. And I think that kind of, because of that, that overrode some of the issues that were with that particular show. So the answer is the program from that is my favorite piece.
Yeah. You know, as I understand it, that he was very charismatic, and the short time I had met or talked with him, I would agree with that. And I remember, again, Chip Romero was talking about how that when the Magic Show was running and that he would go to do a TV show or had another show or something, that there was someone who filled in for him. But it didn't sell out until he came back, because people were coming to see Doug, not just the Magic Show.
Yeah, yeah. And there were some of the replacements for him for the Magic Show that could only do certain tricks. And he would there was only one. I think you mentioned this with Chip. There was only one understudy that did the torn and restored paper trick. He didn't want everyone for them to do that. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, the show was very successful. I mean, it ran for a long time. So
now, were some of the people then, Neil, do you know, who were understudies, were they professional magicians? Were they interested in magic, or were they just actors there in Broadway?
I think they're actors. One of them, I think he trained them. So I think he ran them through the paces. That's what I think. So, I mean, there was one main understudy that ran with it for a long time, and I do know that Doug personally trained him.
Because I know sometimes in theme parks, for an example, that there will be like a magic show at a theme park that they just train. The choreographer will teach everybody how to dance and teach a magician a couple of magic tricks and how to tip over the box and whatever they need to do. But they're really not magicians. They're just actors doing their part. Yeah. And so what you're saying, it sounds like that the people who replaced Doug also were just actors.
Yeah, well, I mean, the illusions were so complex that I don't think I think he had to train them, because, I mean, I haven't seen the show, obviously, but I've seen a lot of pictures.
Right.
And just reading the script and everything. I mean, there's a lot of, like, intense things that went on. So I think he had to actually get hands-on with that, though.
Interesting. And why did that finally come to a conclusion, the magic show?
I just think it ran its course. Doug was no longer part of the show, and I think it's just sort of a... It had run a while, and that was just its natural ending. But, I mean, I think by the time it ended, I don't think he had performed with the show in, like, 2 years at that point. He definitely wanted – once the specials hit, he definitely wanted to be done with the show. So.
Right. And as I recall, wasn't that true that the Magic Show was one of the longest-running musicals at the time?
Yes. I mean, there's been several since then that have surpassed it, but at the time.
Yes, at the time I thought that was, I mean, that you've got, Andrew Lloyd Webber, who is anything he touches seems like, that's going to be running forever. But this, so he certainly predated Webber.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think anybody at that time had seen something like it. And it's, at its heart, it's just a really simple, sweet show. But the music is really good. It's done by Stephen Schwartz. And it just had a lot happening, a lot of heart. And I think people just responded to that and dug. And I mean, and you talked about it with Chip. It's like a lot of the illusions were older illusions mm-hmm. that he gathered for this, but they had never really been done in that way.
Right, right, right. Well, as we start to wrap up, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about as far as trying to things that you have planned for the website as you continue to evolve, or maybe a plea for other people if they've got any stories or things they want to share for a documentary?
Yeah, I mean, anybody that's out there that what we would like to feature for the documentary is people's collections and also just pictures that they may have, like rare pictures. I'm always looking for pictures of Doug as a kid or that sort of thing. Anybody that has something they want to show of Doug for the website or maybe for the documentary, I'll be happy to speak with them. So they can come to the website and there's all the information on where you can contact me. So please do. And for the future, we just have more interviews planned. I mean, I'm always trying to seek people out. So I definitely have a backlog of people that I will be speaking to. So.
And how will they contact you?
Well, they can go to the website, which is www.dougheadingproject.com. And the email is doug@gmail.com. So that those are the best ways.
And then get hold of you that way. Okay.
Yeah. And I always write back. So.
Okay. Perfect. Well, as I start to wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So what would be your magic word or phrase, or what is your mantra that you live by?
Well, I was thinking about this, and I think a lot of people for Doug, they always use the word wonder, but I don't want to use that. Yeah. I think curiosity is really what I think is important with Doug and the way that I think about the two. He was always curious about life and the levels of magic and the higher consciousness that he could obtain. So I think that's a perfect word there. So,
curiosity. I like that. Yeah,
yeah.
That'd be very good then too. Well, Neil, thank you very much. And I wish you good luck, certainly continued success with the Henning Project and also with the upcoming documentary and Kickstarter.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Let me know whenever that's going to Yeah, as soon as that gets ready, that I'd be glad to try to point people that way as well to try to get this funded.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you. And and your podcast is fantastic too. So.
Oh, well, thank you, Neil. I appreciate that a lot. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Neil McNally for the Doug Henning Project. This is Scotty out. I want to thank Neil McNally for being my guest on the Magic Word Podcast this week. It was really a lot of interesting information that he shared, and I hope things work out with the documentary. I think that could be a very important and seminal part of our magic history to have something like that to document Doug Henning's life. And also, as a follow-up, a few weeks ago when we did have the podcast with Chip Romero, he talked about possibly having a Doug Henning convention, and I was thinking some sort of a weekend type of a thing, and that may be something that we can put together. So if you are interested in that, please let me know. I'm kind of interested just to kind of see who would be showing up for something like this. I think it could be a fun weekend, and we can have some people who have worked with Doug Henning, who knew him, tell some stories. I think maybe just kind of a one-time, one-off type of convention would be interesting. So if you're interested in attending, give me some ideas and let me know what you think. You can either leave a comment here on the blog, which would be great, in the comment section on themagicwordpodcast.com, or you can send me an email, scott@themagicwordpodcast.com. Either way, I would appreciate it, but if you leave a comment, I'm sure others can add to those comments and kind of give their ideas of what they think about having a Doug Henning weekend as well. And now for a word from me. Actually, a few words. This is called the Magic Word Podcast, and it is about magic and magicians, but it's also a podcast that I have put together. So to a degree, it's something about me and that I haven't really said too much about myself or my recent situation. And but now that I can share something with you, the listeners, my wife just passed this past week. On Wednesday morning, May the 2nd, at 422. We've been married for nearly 43 years. We were married on May the 16th, and back in 75, and we would have had 43 years coming up here. So it was a lot of fun. My best friend and my partner, who shared all of my dreams and the stage with me. She assisted me in all of our stage shows, and we perform different places and travel around the world, and have two wonderful sons and daughters-in-law, as well as four great grandchildren. They're not great grandchildren, but wonderful grandchildren, granddaughters as well. But Kathy has been with me for all this time, ups and downs. We moved and traveled and whatever. And we have a ton of stories. And this week, later this Saturday night, we're going to be having a celebration of life that will be here in Houston. I plan on putting this on Facebook also and doing a live stream. So those of you who are around the world who cannot participate nor physically join us, that if you want to log in to my Facebook page and you can watch it there, or if you miss it in real time, it will be posted so that you can watch it at a later time. But that will begin at 4 p.m. on, actually a little bit probably prior to that, when the bagpipe music starts playing. But we're going to have that on at least by 4 p.m. Central Standard Time this Saturday, May the 12th. And I also want to thank all of the outpouring of sentiment, all of the prayers and thoughts that people have been sending me. I have felt the warmth and the love of this, of everyone, over the most recent few days. When I posted this on Facebook, I had hundreds and hundreds of probably 1,000 emails and texts, and people who have made nice comments. And I wanted to thank each and every one of you. I just, there's no way that I can go back in and respond to everybody, which was in part why that I have waited so long to do this, because it was in last April of 2017 whenever this first happened. What my wife had was a glioblastoma. It's a brain tumor. It was grade 4, and it was diagnosed immediately as that, and they said you have 14 months to live. And so over the past year, I've kind of kept somewhat of a low profile as far as limiting some of my travel and kind of having my life on hold for a while I've been working and tending to her, as she's had her appointments and different MRIs and scans and treatments and chemotherapy, and then finally, over the last couple of months, having her here at home for hospice, in-home hospice, where we've had some people and nurses who have been coming in, and I've been caring for her. And then whenever I went to the recent 4F convention, put her into a assisted living facility for a few days, and got home, that her situation had regressed such that she was not going to be able to come home, and I would not be able to care for her the way that I had been from before. So she stayed there. Our sons came, and she saw all of us one last time before she decided that she was done. She had stopped taking food and fluids, and within a few days then passed peacefully, and I was able to be in bedside beside her. But it's just that during the past year, I know there were so many people who would have been contacting me, and I feel like that with all of your very nice wishes and sentiments, I know that everybody would want to know how she's doing, and it would have taken more time away from other things than I needed to do with her. And I was afraid that with the outpouring of sentiment that I, again, could not get around to everybody and responding to everyone's texts and emails and phone calls. Now that she's passed, I do have that time, and I would say that my grieving process has been helped greatly by those of you who have reached out. I know there have been several who have called, and there are others who haven't because or sent a message because you don't know what to say. And in situations like that, I've learned you don't have to say anything. It's just the sentiment of what you have done just by reaching out. It means a lot and has helped me to know that within this caring community that everyone feels the way that they do, that have contacted me from Paris to Auckland, New Zealand, and from across the world, and across the country. It's been amazing, and I'm thankful for each of my friends and each of my listeners, all of you guys over the years who have been listening. And this has been therapeutic for me then, and something to do and keeping my mind active and working with this podcast as well over the last year since she'd been diagnosed. And again, she was given 14 months to live, and that was a pretty narrow bell curve, they were saying, because of the type of brain tumor that she had and where it was located, that they could fairly well estimate it was going to be about that amount of time, and they were pretty much on schedule because although she was diagnosed in April, they said that probably started in February, so that would have been about 14 months. You know, when I talk with David Benn, my friend in Canada, whose wife also died of a glioblastoma, she had passed within 3 months, and he was saying it was closer to the brain stem, the top of the spine, and so it depends upon, I guess, how near that it is to the brainstem as to how long it's going to last, and the success of the surgery and removing the tumor. And they, again, had removed this, but she'd been paralyzed on her right side and had the neuropathy for the last few months, and her speech was such that she couldn't really talk. And also, although we had attended some conventions and she had lost some hair and was wearing a wig, people were always glad to see her. She had a great spirit, and we and always was friendly to everyone. And so thank you guys very much for listening to this little grieving process here. And I thank you for your kind prayers, thoughts, and well wishes. Even if you don't contact me, which is fine, we've got like 15,000 subscribers, and so there are a lot of people out there. I couldn't respond to everybody, so I just know and I can that you're out there, and that I can feel your love, and I will continue to work with the podcast here, and in future years I have still a lot of plans. And since I'm on my own, I've got, you know, plans to travel and visit with other magicians and everything as well, and to continue to bring you some quality podcasts. And again, I thank you guys very much for listening. But I'm living and doing fine. And I, again, thank you very much. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and live your life to the fullest every day, because you don't know when that last day will be. This is Scotty out.